First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
The new year is underway, so will we see less inflation in 2023? Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we preview Jacksonville's Global Business Luncheon with Simon Rabinovich of The Economist. He's going to jump on the line as we talk about inflation, China, and more. You can join us, too. It's 549-2937. Then later, everything you need to know about the growing popularity of Dry January. Maybe you're trying it. That and more ahead. But first this morning, from the outlook for inflation this year to tensions with China, the continuing global march of COVID-19, and more, we're pleased to welcome Simon Rabinovich, U.S. editor of The Economist. He'll talk next week downtown, courtesy of the World Affairs Council of Jax and their Global Business Luncheon. We have a preview right now. Simon, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you. And here in studio, John Alaska with the World Affairs Council. Hey, John. Plus you, everybody, what are your concerns about inflation? Are you hoping it eases off more this year? What are your questions about China? Trade issues, COVID spreading across borders, and more. The lines are open. Join us. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Well, Simon, let's start, if we could, with a topic on everyone's minds, inflation. What's the outlook for inflation hopefully easing a bit this year?
Well, I think if you just look at inflation narrowly, you know, to the exclusion of everything else, you could say it's an optimistic forecast in that, you know, inflation already was beginning to recede at the end of 2022, and the momentum is clearly towards lower price increases throughout this year. We'll be getting the next big inflation reading, the next CPI reading next week, and it's likely to show that year-on-year inflation has fallen to below 7%. So still very high by historical standards, but lower than the highs of 9% last year. So narrowly speaking, that's the good news. The sting in the tail, the bad news, is that the way in which inflation is coming down is by having a broader economic slowdown. Mm-hmm. Federal Reserve has increased interest rates aggressively. The way that interest rate increases work is that it takes time really for the economy to feel the impact. The housing market obviously has already slowed down sharply, but there's already signs that it's beginning to spill over to the economy more broadly. The manufacturing sector is looking quite weak. Employment is holding up for the time being, but the expectation is that inflation will come down, but unemployment will go up at the same time. So it's really, a good news, bad news scenario.
What are your thoughts about projections of a recession this year?
I think it's, the base case is that there probably will be a recession. Potentially, we could be, at the beginnings of one right now. Obviously, there's a lag in terms of economic data being published, so we don't know what the first quarter is going to be reported to be until April. But if you look at kind of the immediate real-time indicators, there's already a fair bit of softening in the economy. I suppose the silver lining is that a recession, technically defined, is two consecutive quarters of negative growth. Well, there's a difference, though, between growth being negative to the tune of, say, 0.2, 0.3%, and being negative 2 or 3%. That's a big difference. And there's a lot of reasons to think that although the economy is slowing, that there is still some underlying resilience. As I mentioned, the labor market is still incredibly robust. On average, still adding about 200,000 jobs per month. So that gives employees a certain amount of a cushion as the economy slows. Amazingly, there's still a fair bit of savings that were built up during the COVID pandemic that are still sitting in bank accounts, which both personal as well as corporate. So there's a fair bit more of a cushion going into this recession than typically would be the case. And companies as well, given how difficult it has been to hire workers over the last 18 months, may be more reluctant to engage in wide-scale layoffs, the kind of thing that would make a recession much more vicious. So, you know, the economy is slowing, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be the sort of harsh recession that we saw in 2008 and that we saw at the very beginning of the COVID pandemic.
Well, that's some good news, at least. For that, I'm grateful, Simon. What about the U.S. current industrial policy? This is something you're well-versed in over at The Economist, and you'll be discussing this at your talk next week downtown.
Yeah, no, you're I think you're right to draw attention to this because, I mean, so much of the coverage and the headlines day to day focus on, you know, what's the latest inflation reading, which obviously is incredibly important. But these are relatively short-term developments. Inflation goes up now and inflation goes down at the end of the year. Industrial policy, I think, speaks to something much more fundamental, which is that, you know, the current government, the Biden administration, but more than just the Biden administration, that, you know, to a certain extent, there's a bipartisan consensus, is really trying to change the structure of the American economy, of American industry, you know, in the belief that traditionally, America has not had an outright industrial policy, you know, where they target specific sectors and provide subsidies to entrance into those sectors, to companies to try to build them up, to try to establish some kind of national advantage. Historically, America has shied away from that and has really been, you know, much more of a free market driven economy. That is changing. They've looked at how successful China has been. And that largely has been through kind of state-guided, state-driven economic policy. They've looked at, you know, the beginning of the pandemic when supply chains looked really vulnerable. There was concerns about whether, you know, America could even produce enough surgical masks. And they've looked at climate change and kind of the feeling that corporate America wasn't doing enough to address it. There wasn't yet enough investment in industries like wind turbine and solar power and electric vehicles. And they've concocted effectively a robust industrial policy that's largely based on heavy subsidies, on tax credits, targeting sectors like semiconductors and electric vehicles. Passed, you know, through last year through the Big Chips Act, a $52 billion act, plus the Inflation Reduction Act, which has about $300 billion for climate spending. So we're at the beginnings now of the implementation of these incredibly ambitious pieces of legislation, doling out the money. And it's something that America really has not done for decades. So it's a fascinating moment for the economy.
We'll go to your calls in a moment for Simon Rabinovich, U.S. editor of The Economist. He will speak next week downtown, courtesy of the World Affairs Council of JAX, 549-2937. John with World Affairs will tell us in a few more minutes how you can get your tickets to this event. But you mentioned China, Simon. Tell us about the reopening of the mainland China border with Taiwan, with Hong Kong, I should say, and why we need to care about what's going on half a world away.
Well, I mean, what they've gone through there is remarkable. I was actually based in China for quite a few years, covering the economy and the financial sector there, including at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And I came over to America in mid-2021. And pretty much from the start of the pandemic until more or less the time that I left, until mid-2021, you know, China was convinced, and many people around the world were convinced, that China more or less had the right approach, this kind of incredibly strict COVID zero policy, where, you know, if you found yourself caught up in their controls and having to be placed in quarantine, obviously it was very difficult. But for 99% of the population, life continued as normal. I mean, I can tell you personally that, you know, we have young children. They were back at school in person 2 months after COVID began. We were back in the office in person. So we never dealt with the kinds of online learning or social distancing that much of the rest of the world went through. So it really seemed like the right approach. But the thing about the COVID zero policy is that it's supposed to be used to buy time. And that time that they bought should have been used for vaccinating the population and getting them ready for relaxing the COVID controls. which they did not do. So if you look at the vaccination rates in China, they're actually incredibly low. Well, lo and behold, you know, what happened then with Omicron is that a much more transmissible variant of COVID came through. No longer were the controls able to work. They became a lot harsher. Many, many more people were placed into quarantine, still couldn't stop the spread of COVID. And finally, in the last month, you know, much to people's surprise, China basically threw in the towel and they realized they could no longer stop COVID. And so what's happened in the last month is an absolute 180-degree pivot, to the point that they're just letting COVID basically rip through the population like wildfire. You know, by some estimates, as many as 50% of people in Shanghai, a city of 30 million people, have been infected with COVID in the past months. So they're going through an incredibly difficult period right now. I suppose the light at the end of the tunnel, if you will, is that they're kind of getting it over with quickly. I mean, obviously, there'll be extreme pain and high cost for some parts of the population. But for the majority of people, as we know, COVID is difficult, but it's not, you know, it's not fatal. And so, you know, what we're looking at now is a much more accelerated timeline for the reopening of China and the reopening of the border with Hong Kong, as you mentioned, and the beginning the resumption of international travel is a sign that they think they're kind of getting near the end of the big COVID hump. But it's really just been a tremendous shift in policy.
Let's go to your calls now for Simon Rabinovich of The Economist. You don't even have to buy a ticket, although we really encourage you to do so, to attend next week's Global Business Luncheon on behalf of the World Affairs Council, because I believe they're almost sold out. 549-2937, Tom at NAS Jax. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning. My comment is about inflation, specifically groceries. I do much of my grocery shopping, but not all of it, at the commissary on the Naval Air Station. And prices there have been coming down steadily. Many items have returned to the prices they were before all the inflation concerns had come to a head. Now, the few times I do, or sometimes when I do have to shop retail, like Publix specifically, their prices don't come down at all. Their prices go up and up and up, and it's, I can get the same thing at the commissary that's on the public shelf for anywhere from 10 to 15% less. And then if I go into Publix the next week, the price there has gone up again, even though it has not changed at commissaries. The commissaries are very price sensitive. So if the price is going to go up a penny, they're going to raise it a penny. Now, if the prices are coming down, they're going to bring them down. I just wish that the retailers would get on board with that idea.
Right, Tom. Thank you for that. I grew up going to commissaries on Air Force bases myself, so I know what you're talking about just a little bit. Simon, it's interesting to hear from people out there about what they're seeing in different stores.
That's a fascinating observation from Tom, and it certainly speaks to the extent to which, you know, big companies are happy to raise prices when prices are going up. And when prices are going down, they're much more reluctant to obviously to lower them. They want to bake in their profit margin if they can. So it's fascinating. It's unfortunate to hear that. I mean, from a macroeconomic standpoint, it is clear that there are now a series of important prices that are beginning to go down, or where inflation, the rate of inflation is slowing much more sharply. Food is one of them. You might not believe that if you're not shopping at the commissary, but I guess Tom's point is that, you know, if for price sensitive shops, you know, it is clear that you're beginning to see some decline in food inflation, if not outright, you know, deflation. Energy prices have come down. We all remember how expensive gas was half a year ago and how it's cheaper now. That's good news. The property market is slowing, which not a great news, I guess, if you're a homeowner, but if you're a home buyer or if you're a renter, that's kind of good news. So there are some really important prices that are coming down. When the Federal Reserve says that it's still concerned about inflation, what it's focusing on is a very specific measure these days, which is what they call core services ex property, which sounds a bit technical. All it means is that if you're ignoring food, ignoring fuel costs, ignoring property costs, which are a lot more volatile, and focusing in on things like you know, what does it cost to go to a restaurant? What does it cost to go to a movie theater or to an amusement park? These are kind of the core services. Flight tickets as well would be there. And the reason they're focusing on these is that what they now see as the potential driver of persistent inflation is the really, really tight labor market feeding into persistent wage growth. And they're concerned about that because you risk getting into a wage price spiral where prices go up, so employees demand higher wages, which then drives prices up, which then leads to yet higher wage demands. And when you get into that kind of spiral, there's a real risk that the central bank loses control of inflation. So obviously it's important to shoppers like Tom that food prices are going down or are not going up. But as far as the central bank is concerned, what they're really laser focused on right now is wage costs and the labor market more broadly.
All right. So, John Alaska, World Affairs Council of JAX, before we go to more calls waiting in the queue, this is just a short preview of the talk that Simon will be giving next week. This is your global business luncheon. So people coming out to this talk will hear about what's going on with the local economy and also the global economy. It's great to get his perspective as someone who's looking at this at the macro level.
Right. And these are really designed for the business community to be able to learn and rather glean insights from these national leaders on economics and policy to bring, you know, advice here locally as to what's going on. And so, you know, you have CEOs in attendance, C-suite. But you also have lawyers and people who are small business owners. And so it's a real mingling of the business community at these talks.
You guys always bring such fascinating speakers to town. This is a ticketed event. We'll repeat this again in a few minutes. But how can people attend the talk with Simon?
So you can get tickets on our website, which is worldaffairscouncil.jax.org. It's the marquee event on our website right now. So you go on and you'll see it right there. And tickets are $65 for members and $85 for non-members. It includes lunch at the River Club, as well as Simon's presentation and a Q&A session with Simon as well.
This is next Tuesday, the 10th.
Yes.
549-2937, Daryl in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. Great show. Good guest. I have this question that's been in my mind. What would be the impact on inflation if we actually were to stop the illegal immigration that comes in? Because all of our food and all of our houses in some form is being built or picked or fed by that. And I'm assuming that we're not going to stop living in houses and not stop eating. So they would have to have a pretty significant increase in payroll if they actually had to pay the regular wage. Has anybody ever done any studies on what the impact of, you know, stopping the illegal immigration would have on the inflation?
Daryl, I'm almost 100% sure the answer to that is yes. It has been studied. Simon, immigration.
I mean, Daryl's absolutely, you know, hit a nail on the head. Which is, I mean, not just illegal immigration, but immigration more generally is obviously a critical component of the American labor market. So, you know, as I said, you know, one of the big issues right now with inflation, underlying inflation, is how tight the labor market is. Well, if you look at the overall labor force today, one of the big detractions, one of the big subtractions, I should say, from the labor market is that on the legal side, in fact, immigration has more or less flatlined since before the pandemic. So there's roughly, researchers estimate, roughly 1.5 to 2 million quote-unquote missing workers. So even with all of the talk and all of the inflows across the border illegally, actually the big picture is that there has already been a decline in overall immigration numbers through legal channels. And that is having an impact on the labor market. That's one of the reasons why companies are struggling to find workers. That's one of the reasons then why nominal wage growth is as strong as it is. Now, if you were to follow Daryl's logic and ask, you know, what would happen if they actually stopped outright illegal immigration, well, obviously, a lot of the illegal immigrants are going towards kind of lower income jobs. The political concern is that these people are stealing our work. The reality is that there's not many Americans who are willing to do a lot of the jobs that those migrants are willing to do, and you know, to do effectively and eagerly. And so if there was to be, you know, a full out stop to all immigration, that would have an incredibly deleterious impact on the labor market, on the ability of companies to deliver basic services, on the ability of farmers to pick their crops. And that would be felt by consumers, when they see prices go up. So absolutely, that's something that people have researched. It's something that the Federal Reserve is very aware of as well. I guess you then get into the next question, which is, you know, okay, you accept that immigration is important to America, but what's the right way to design an immigration system? And I think everybody would agree that the kind of border crossings that we're seeing and the way that's being handled is not really the right way to go forward. There should be a more systematic process by which America is able to, you know, pick who comes into the country and prioritize different people from different countries or focused on different sectors. So you then get into the political question. Unfortunately, the story of the past couple decades is that seems to be an unsolvable problem. But purely from an economic standpoint, Daryl's absolutely right. America needs immigrants, and without them, inflation would be even worse.
Ron in Mandarin. Hi, Ron. Good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. Hey, Simon, this is probably off topic because it's more geopolitical than economic, but, you know, you have such a broad understanding of things. I was just wondering, you know, one thing that's really bothering me is these migrants that come from South America have to go through a no man's land between South America, Colombia, and Panama, Central America. And there is so much lawlessness and violence, and these people are being preyed on there. Isn't there something that governments could get together? I mean, isn't anybody concerned about these people being preyed on like that?
I mean, I think you're right. I think there is a lot of concern about that. But, you know, as I said, the solution from America, it's not going to be something that they can implement in those countries. It's got to be something that's done at the border. I mean, they could be, more immigration centers in those countries to basically open up the door to you know, good people from those countries to have a legal path to get into America. But the situation right now is that there's a huge demand from those countries to get into America, and so a huge supply of would-be immigrants. And the only real way they can get in is illegally, which then requires them to pass through, as you say, you know, dangerous countries where they're often mistreated and subjected to abuse and have to pay a huge fortune to get to get to the border. So it's a really bad system. But the solution has to start with immigration reform in Congress. And sadly, that's been a dead letter for the last, for the last 15 years.
Here's a tweet from Susan. There's a lot of talk right now, I'm hearing, about workers' wages, but what about million-dollar CEO salaries and bonuses? As John mentioned a minute ago, Simon, some of the people you'll be speaking to at the River Club next week will be CEOs, but what about that?
Executive compensation is a hot-button issue, and it's hard to look at some of the packages that are paid out and not think that they're obscene. I mean, how can anybody possibly be worth tens of millions of dollars? So it's a concern. And I think it's more of a political than a pure economic issue, if you will, in the sense that the macroeconomic impact of those, excessive salaries is, as a percentage of the economy, it's negligible. But politically, it's a real issue. People don't like seeing it, and there's questions about the fundamental value that's being delivered, and obviously there's been concerns, going back to the financial crisis about, why it is that CEOs are able to get huge payouts when the stock market is up, and their pay is not really clawed back then when their stock price starts to fall. So, they get all the upside, and they don't actually suffer any of the downside. So it's a politically contentious issue, but it's a hard one because, do we want to have the government laying out guidelines and saying companies can or should pay certain amounts of money. That's contentious. And you know, I don't think we want to have the money, the government setting people's wages. So it's, you know, how the market disciplines those kinds of companies is something to watch. I don't think it's going to be a Washington-driven answer, though.
With all of that said, John, this is just, as I mentioned, a short preview of what people can expect at your Global Business Luncheon next week. Almost running out of time to buy tickets. Not that many tickets left for Simon. How can people be part of it?
You can visit our website at worldaffairscouncil.org and get your tickets. Prices vary whether or not you're a member or non-member. But if you do join as a member, you get that lovely member price. And we would love to have you there. It's at the River Club from 12 to 1:30.
Simon Rabinovich, U.S. editor at The Economist. John Alaska of World Affairs Council. Thank you both, guys.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Meanwhile, later, Create Jax takes us all around town to see what's happening this month. We'll also look at the growing popularity of Dry January. But up next, a new AI bot that is upending the tech industry, and it looks like even your kids' homework. That's next. Well, a new artificial intelligence bot seems to be on the verge of upending the whole tech industry. It's called ChatGPT, I should say. It's an AI chatbot system released in November by the AI research and development company OpenAI. You can ask the bot questions and get pretty good answers. It can write computer programs or code. It can even write poems, even whole papers. Now, ChatGPT is an exciting tool, but like anything, there's another side. Some are worried that students will use it to cheat on their term papers or that it might even put people out of work. To learn more about ChatGPT and its pros and cons, we're pleased to touch base with WJCT's own digital media director, Ray Hollister. He's here in studio. Hey, Ray.
Good morning.
Hey. Hey. Happy New Year. And
you too.
We've been hearing so much about this. Tell us more about ChatGPT.
Yeah, so ChatGPT is basically a computer program that runs on a website that's designed to hold conversations with humans. And it works by taking in what a person says and then generates a response based on what it has learned from previous conversations. And the goal is to make it sound more like a real person so it can have natural sounding conversations with people. Mm-hmm. And basically, the developers gave ChatGPT just a bunch of books and articles and websites to read with billions of words in them. And as the robot read these books and articles, it started to understand how the words go together and how they can be used to form sentences and paragraphs. And it starts to figure out which words are more likely to come next in a sentence based on the words that came before them. So this robot does this by using a special kind of math called machine learning, and it looks at all the words in the books and the articles and tries to find patterns and connections between them. And the more it reads, the better it gets at understanding and using language. And after a while, the robot sounds really good at talking to people and having conversations that sound like they're coming from a real person.
Wow. Now, some schools are already banning this tool for students. Can they use it to cheat on their homework?
Yeah, the thing is, it is really powerful at creating what sounds like it's coming from a real person. But instead of banning ChatGPT and other tools like it, it's a better idea for the school districts to educate students and teachers on how to use them responsibly and establish guidelines for their use. That way, students and educators can take advantage of the benefits that these technologies offer. That being said, it is important for school districts to carefully consider the potential uses and limitations of ChatGPT, mm-hmm. because it can generate text that contains offensive or inappropriate content as well.
Now, you're going to give us a real-time demonstration of how ChatGPT works. What's the example?
The example is everything I just said. Every answer I just gave you was, except for what I'm saying right now, was directly from ChatGPT.
What?
I put these questions, because I figured these are kind of things that you would be interested in knowing. I put them into ChatGPT last night and generated them. And we've got some actually that I did this morning. So I took an article by A.G. Gankarski on Jax Today about the mayor's debate and asked it to create a poem for me.
A poem about the mayor's race. I love it.
I'll have Siri read it here.
Okay, here we go.
Candidates must introduce themselves with all their might, for the opposition will soon attack, and the campaign will surely turn negative. No turning back. Jacksonville has 10 candidates in the race, up from 9 in a previous place. This is the most crowded and diverse field in history, but it remains to be seen who will qualify and be victorious in this mystery. Al Ferraro owns the lane of Duval populism, but Nate Monroe says he lacks fundraising. Oh, how catastrophic. He may be third among Republicans, but still a complication, like Mike Hogan in 2011, causing a sensation. Leanna Gutierrez Cumber and Daniel Davis are the other two viable Republicans in the race. But Davis' committee has already started the contrast ads with such disgrace, accusing Cumber of being a liberal lobbyist who supported California radicals. She responds, calling the ad full of distortions and lies. A total scandal. The mayoral race has only just begun, and already the negativity has won. We can only hope for a campaign filled with more positivity and less scrutiny. But until then, we'll just have to see who comes out on top. Finally victorious and not feeling so blue.
Oh my gosh.
And it spit that poem out in about 10 seconds.
Wow.
And what I found that ChatGPT does really well is the kind of work that doesn't require creative original thought. Mm-hmm. If you're taking something and converting it into something else, like writing a tweet or writing a summary of an episode of a show or a radio show or a television show, it does fantastic at that. The only thing I've found, I've been testing it a lot and playing with it a lot, is it's a little repetitive. You don't notice it at first, but once you've done like 20 or 50 of these, you start seeing like, you can ask it to give it a tone, like make this snarky or make this quippy or punny. It'll start saying things the same way often, but we do that as humans too. I mean, I say so way too often, and it just has these little habits that it'll do.
So are we all out of a job? I think that's the question a lot of people have about this technology.
Not yet. I think
it's not very reassuring.
Look, you and I are going to retire, okay? But our grandkids, our grandkids, I'm worried about. No, it's a tool. It's like a calculator. And actually, this is also from ChatGPT. It is a tool that can help people do their job. So just like calculators didn't replace mathematicians, this isn't going to replace writers, but it might make their jobs a ton easier to where they can create more content and do more things.
On the bright side, thank you, Ray. He's digital media director Ray Hollister here at WJCT Public Media. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now that the festive period has passed, maybe you're one of the millions of Americans out there trying Dry January. It's a global movement to try to abstain from alcohol for the first month of the year. You can even download the app for a little help. Dry January is getting more popular all the time for a number of reasons. With more about Dry January, we're pleased to welcome Dr. Carter Stout. He's a psychologist and the author of We Are All Addicts: The Soul's Guide to Kicking Your Compulsions. Dr. Stout, good morning. Oh, we can't. I can see you on the Zoom, but I can't hear you. Can you turn your audio on?
Oh,
there you are. I think I can hear you now. Okay, So, Dr. Stout, why is January, Dry January, catching on so much, do you think? It's really getting big. Oh, can't hear you again. You know what, doctor? Let's take a quick break, and we can try to get your audio up so that we can do this Q&A. Stand by, everyone. All right, here we are back again with Dr. Carter Stout, author of We Are All Addicts, as we talk about Dry January. Hey, Carter Stout, are you there?
Good morning.
Oh, there you go. Good to have you. So
great to have you too.
Let's talk about Dry January. It's catching on more and more each year. Why do you think that is?
Well, I feel like there's so much awareness now about health and wellness that is really circumventing the globe. Here in the United States, it's really trending. There are a lot of people talking about it. It's a national conversation. And I think people are trying to incorporate things into their lives that make them healthier and feel better about themselves.
Physicians will tell you that if you abstain from alcohol, even for 1 month out of the year, the health benefits carry past January. So that's one good reason to try it, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, my patients that are trying dry January have already felt the benefits in just a few days. They're sleeping better. They seem to be more present. They have more increased energy. And, you know, psychologically, they're just feeling really proud and really good about themselves.
Now, your book is titled We Are All Addicts. You yourself are a recovering addict. When you say we are all addicts, you're talking about far more than alcohol. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yes, the book really, the premise of the book is that addiction simply is a loop of obsessive thoughts followed by compulsive actions, and that most of us engage in these type of patterns on a regular basis. We do it with our phones, with technology. We do it with food, we do it with relationships and love, we do it with work, we do it with exercise, and we even do it with certain emotions like anger or anxiety. Mm.
That really broadens the discussion, doesn't it? To basically the entire human race.
Exactly, exactly. So I talk about in the book that it's archetypal, that it's something that we all know, and I'm trying to really demystify this idea of addiction. So that it's not considered just the other person has this affliction, but it's something really that we all share.
Now, you counsel patients on how to overcome addictive behaviors without a 12-step program or inpatient treatment or even abstinence. Of course, Dry January is basically abstinence, but how do you do that?
Well, you know, and I have nothing against the 12-step program. I think it can help a lot of people. And but there are ways, certainly. And, you know, the first really is, especially if you are trying dry January, to be accountable, to let people know what you're trying to do, to have them check in with you, for you to check in with them, and to wear it as a badge of honor, to be proud about it and not carry any shame around what you're trying to do. So that would be the first step. And also what helps a lot is to get out in the world and to be active in your life. Don't isolate. Loneliness feeds addiction and feeds addictive cycles. So try and be active, trying to get out, be around your friends, be around your inner circle of family. And I would say as well, a very practical step would be just remove the alcohol from your home. If you have excess alcohol and you're trying to do Dry January, just give it to a friend to store for you for the month or throw it away.
Now, you also say there are three items you should carry with you when you're trying to kick a habit. What are they?
Well, I like to carry a photograph of my children and of my family with me, because I'm 17 years sober now from alcohol and from substances. And I'm not only doing it for myself, but I'm doing it for the people that I love in the world, so I can be a better father and be a better person. And so that's just a reminder when I look at that photo of who I'm doing this for. Also, I would say carry a good book with you. One of the biggest challenges when you're trying to get sober is people that don't feel that they have a purpose or feel like they're bored or procrastinating about something. And if you have a good book, you know, when you have 15 minutes to yourself, you can just take it out and lose yourself in a story. And that can be very helpful. And the third is a journal. Write your thoughts down on paper every day, every morning, and getting your thoughts out is really a good way to promote healing and to understand yourself better.
All great advice. You also want to guide people into how they can manifest their sobriety. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think manifesting is something that's been talked about a lot. And most people manifest, but they manifest negatively. They think of the worst case scenario, or they think of how hard something is going to be, or they worry about the future. And if we can envision ourselves completing something or doing something that's positive, I think that's a really powerful statement. The first step in doing anything is really believing that we can do it. And so envisioning that and manifesting that is a way to accomplish it.
All great advice for this Dry January month. Thank you, Dr. Carter Stout, psychologist and author of the new book, We Are All Addicts, The Soul's Guide to Kicking Your Compulsions. Happy Dry January, Doc.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me this morning.
You too. And folks, that app is free. You can download it. It's called Try Dry at your App Store. In a moment, Create Jax takes us all around town to see what's happening in this new year. We'll be right back.
Congarean Pin, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpin.com.
How healthcare might change when pandemic emergency laws end. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. Join me Saturday at 4 for What's Health Got to Do with It, only on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville.
The Supreme Court overturned decades of abortion rights precedent last year, a decision that is emboldening conservative lawmakers at the state level.
Conservative states are not going to let up on the gas.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A look at anti-abortion laws under consideration across the country this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Celeste Headlee. Ragtime was a popular form of music in the early 20th century. 100 years later, piano virtuoso Marc-André Hamelin wants to rekindle the love for rag.
It's one of those tunes that seems like it's always been around, you know? There was never a time when it didn't exist, you know? To me, it's timeless.
Next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
America's legal trade in cannabis is in trouble. Businesses are struggling to make a profit, and evidence is growing that the industry isn't delivering on promises to build black wealth and right past wrongs. We take a closer look at POTS problems next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new year, so naturally, Create Jax is out this month with their curated list of the hottest places to see and be seen all around town this month. Catalina Sylvain is here to get us on the move. Hey, good morning.
Good morning and Happy New Year,
Melissa. Happy New Year to you. Love seeing your beautiful face. So what's happening this month?
So much. So much for January. We know that things kind of slow down a little bit in January, but that doesn't mean there's not some really fire events. Mm-hmm. And of course, with Create Jax, you know, we're going to find the best ones for you.
Right.
So this weekend, Saturday, is Groove Suite with Al Pete. Now, Groove Suite kind of is like an online community, and it keeps the true head music fans happy online. But now they're taking it offline and in person to a kickback with the quote-unquote rare songs that we play at home all the time, but you never hear out at the clubs or the parties. So think like Toni Braxton next to the Temptations, and then Nas comes up next. Like, it's just going to be a completely different vibe, highlighting neo soul, R&B, and hip hop. So Mr. Al Pete, who is a local music genius, is going to be doing the show with a special guest. Tickets are only $15, and it includes the first drink and small bites. This is going to be in the Cork Arts District. So the space is a little small, caps at 50. So get your tickets now and don't wait day of.
That's Saturday night with Al Pete. Check it out. Okay. Also this weekend, what is going on with Pancho the producer?
So this is a really great way to get to know Jacksonville's music scene. There's a lot of great local talent here. And so Pancho the producer is doing an album release party for the album Watch that was produced and curated entirely by Pancho, that features a lot of the local talent like Paris Winningham, Simpo, John West, Shad Will, and a lot more. And this is a free event, so you can come in and hear the album before it releases to the public. It's a really, really cool vibe. So it's going to be Sunday, 7 p.m. at Vibe Live Studios.
Free listening party.
Free listening party. You know how much Jacksonville loves a free event.
That's right. Check that out. And then as we head into next week, parents, listen up. Disney's Aladdin is coming to town.
Oh, parents and Disney millennials alike.
Yes,
we are
yes.
All excited.
So, oh, are you a what we call a Disney adult?
I am a Disney childless millennial.
Okay.
That is me. This is really exciting. So we all know the story Aladdin. We know that it's been on Broadway for decades. Well, it's finally coming to Jacksonville.
You're like a real life Jasmine.
Oh my God,
like,
thank you so much.
You look like you really do.
That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
I could see you performing that role so easily.
Oh, that'd be a dream.
Okay, so that kicks off January 10th.
Yep, Tuesday through Sunday. It'll be running at the Jacksonville Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets start at $40, so you could do this with the whole family.
Another interesting series coming back is Untold Stories at the Florida Theater.
Yes, this is a really, really great oral storytelling series that features a diverse range of voices from both natives and transplants to the Northeast Florida area. So we've got 6 storytellers that share their version of the night's theme, which is lightning strikes. So who knows what stories could come from that, but the lineup is always great. And this one has immigration attorney Andrea Reyes, artist Tiffany Matting, educators Andrew Dixon and Larry Knight, filmmaker Franklin Rich, and an artist still in high school, Nevaeh Glover, a poet.
Any relation to Nat Glover?
Who knows? I don't know. You gotta go to Untold Stories and ask her yourself.
Check it out, folks. That is on the 12th at the Florida Theater. Meanwhile, over at the Symphony, they're going to be doing a little Duke Ellington.
Yes, the Jacksonville Symphony has been just getting better and better every season. So January 13th and 14th, this is a tribute to Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn, jazz legends. So they'll be doing timeless compositions over a 40-year period. So think Duke and Ella Fitzgerald, it don't mean a thing. And it'll be joined by vocals of tenor Bernard Holcomb. So it'll be another beautiful night of music at the Jacksonville Center for the Performing Arts. And tickets start at $27.
Okay, let's mention a few other news and notes, beginning with the Jags pregame block party.
Ooh, boy.
This is going to be all lit up over by Intuition Ale Works and Manifest Distillery. Free block party as the playoff hopes for the Jaguars are sky high right now.
Fingers crossed, toes crossed, eyes crossed, all of it. And this is gonna be a huge block party. It starts at 1 o'clock, so you can still go and watch some of the afternoon games. They're gonna have a projector showing those. Beer, cocktail, smoked barbecue, lots of food trucks. It's gonna be wild.
That's on the 7th, kicking off at 1 in the sports complex. I'm guessing they'll see you there, Catalina.
Who knows?
Last but not least, at the Alhambra Theater, starting on the 6th, actually, A Closer Walk with Patsy Cline. That sounds fun.
Right. So Patsy Cline is the only Patsy Cline show to be endorsed by her estate. And it is the most authentic story told about her. And this is just a beautiful tribute to her life, her career. And it'll be at the Alhambra, which is the nation's oldest continuously operating dinner theater. So that's runs from the 6th to the 8th. So that's this weekend. And it's such a cute thing to do, like a little dinner and a show at the Alhambra.
That theater, the Alhambra, is an absolute gem in this community. And, you know, when we went on the air in 2009, they were one of our very first guests. So
no way. How
Craig
sweet.
Smith and Mark Berman are listening over at the Alhambra. Have a great show, guys. Okay. And folks, go to createjax.com/thisweek for the full curated list. That's CRE8jax.com/thisweek. It's the hottest tickets in town, and you can only get it from Create Jax. So thanks, Catalina.
Thank you, Melissa.
And as they like to say, only the boring get bored. There's plenty to do all around town this month, so get out and have some fun. And thanks for listening. Thanks also to our fabulous team. David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella Da Silva, Michelle Corum, and all of you. Drop us a line at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Let us know what's on your mind. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for the company. We'll check in with you again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.